I'm Rick Dedarian, and this is Realms of Memory. If you did a Google search for the most influential scholars in the field of memory studies, you're bound to find the name Jeffrey K. Olick on the short list. A professor of sociology and history at the University of Virginia, his books on the German memory of the Nazi past and the politics of regret have been translated into at least 10 languages. He's the co-founder and past co-president of the Memory Studies Association, the leading professional organization for memory studies scholars. His edited volumes, The Collective Memory Reader and A Cultural History of Memory, offer essential readings in the field and a sweeping overview of the subject of collective memory. I had the chance to talk with Jeff about a range of subjects, from his beginnings in memory studies and the German memory success story to current trends in American collective memory. A conversation with memory studies expert Jeffrey K. Olick in this episode of Realms of Memory. Jeff, welcome to Realms of Memory.
Thank you.
So I got to admit, I tried before each episode, I tried to listen to anything I can find, any presentation I can find. And I've listened to a number of your presentations. And one of the things that intrigued me is that you several times explained at the start of your career, you had an interest in storytelling, in narratives, and that Maurice Halbwachs was really transformational for you, that he allowed you to kind of ground that interest in a kind of disciplinary legitimacy. So that, I was interested if you could explain that. And then also, I heard you briefly mention that you also have a family connection, at least to Germany through your wife. And that was something that had an influence on some of your early decisions, the things you decided to work on. So I was hoping you could start with that.
Well, so Halbwachs is an interesting figure, as you mentioned. When I was in graduate school, sociology was in an interesting moment where it seemed the main approaches were not interested in the kinds of things that had attracted me to it in the first place. So I was looking for legitimacy, as you say, that my interests were in fact belonging into what sociology is supposed to be. And all the messages I was getting from the people around me were that what you're interested in is not really sociology. And so when I discovered Halbwachs, it had this powerful effect on me, because here was a guy who was a protege of Emile Durkheim, who was at the heart of French sociological debates in a formative moment, who was saying the things that I'm interested in, the things that are intriguing me, do count as sociology. Not only that, they're really central to sociology. And so it provided a basis on which I could feel more at home in the discipline that I was studying. You know, sociology in the late 1980s, when I was a graduate student, was largely quantitative on the one side, or it was a particular form of political engagement, both of which were interesting to me, but none of which really captured what it was I wanted to say. And so the reason I came to Halbwachs is I was studying social movements. And one thing we were noticing in a seminar I was taking was that social movements tell stories about who they are and what they do, whether it's the story of a particular figure, the leader of the organization, or whether the organization itself is investing in sort of formal apparatuses of storytelling. And so that puzzled me, because it wasn't the kind of question that sociologists usually ask. We usually ask, you've got an identity, what do you do about it? We don't ask, or we didn't at the time ask, well, where does the identity come from in the first place? And so this was a sort of an insight or a window into where identities get constructed. They get constructed out of narrative. They get constructed as narrative. And so that was the background that led me to the concept of memory. You mentioned the personal connection. The question of Germany came to me, and I knew very little about Germany because I was dating a woman who was from Germany, and I'm a Jew, and the question was, how can that work? The debates we had in our private life were about the second generation, the third generation. We had no personal biographical connection to these kinds of events. So what does that mean for how people can get along? And so the two questions combined for me when I realized that Germany was a really interesting case, because it was a case in which the normal, if there's such a thing, storytelling processes that underwrite identity couldn't work in an easy fashion. What are you going to say? You know, if you're from a country that can't tell a heroic story about its past, you know, in the United States at the time, we were told that the United States is the city on a hill and a special place. And we tell this wonderful, triumphal story. And even if we didn't start out in the right place, we've been redeeming the promises of the early documents. And so we're on this upward trajectory, and we won World War II, and we stand for democracy and freedom and justice, even if we haven't quite gotten there yet. Well, how do you speak for a nation that can't do that in an unproblematic fashion? So that struck me as an empirical puzzle. And I wanted to know, well, what did they say? And what I found out is that there were huge gaps in the scholarly literature. There wasn't a lot asking what they said about it. And so I set out to find out, and I went off to Germany and started reading what they said, the speeches. What did the chancellor, what did the president say when they were compelled or had a reason to speak about this dark period in their past? And some of what I found was what I expected, but a lot of it wasn't. They had very strange, to me, ways of speaking about it. They seemed overly careful about some things and not careful enough about other things. And so to me, this was a great empirical and explanatory puzzle. And it's underwritten my work for better part of 30 years, I would say.
My sense is, if your career starts with a search for disciplinary legitimacy and you find it in Hallvox, and then you end up building a career and helping to shape this field of memory studies. And then maybe towards the end of your career or a later stage of your career, you're spending a lot of time trying to establish the institutional legitimacy of memory studies and trying to anchor it in a history that really hasn't been studied and looked at enough. So you're really trying to establish the legitimacy, the credibility of this field.
Yeah, I mean, you move through different career stages. The first part, you're trying to establish yourself. Then you sort of have a middle. As you get a little older, you want to see, you know, I'm more interested in the success of my students and sort of seeing this thing that I've worked on and find interesting perpetuated. By the same token, I occupy a kind of weird liminal position, which is I spend half of my time trying to convince my friends in memory studies that, remember, Hallvox was a sociologist, and so memory studies really is at its core sociological. And I was going to say the other half, but it's probably less at this point, trying to convince colleagues in sociology, you know, memory is a really interesting and central topic. You ought to pay more attention to it. And both of those are sort of vexed missions, because people are in their channels and like to stick to it. The reason I spend more of my time in memory studies is I love the interdisciplinary context. I just learn a lot. Which is also to say that, you know, all this gets into disciplinary history and disciplinary structure. The questions that animate me, I think, are the same questions that bring people together in memory studies, is we're trying to figure out what to do with the weight of the past. We're from a moral and political position, how much should we talk about it? How should we commemorate? How do we hold people accountable? What kind of monuments do we build? Do we ever take them down? How do these things change? What do we do about this? We're all aware that history is a mixed blessing, let's say. There's tremendous things to admire. I believe there are forms of progress. I would prefer to live today than I would have preferred, I think, to live 200 years ago. By the same token, there's a lot that doesn't go well. And I think the commitment that many people in memory studies share is that we're not going to do better unless we understand and remember what we have done in the past. There's the old cliche, of course, from Santayana, that those who forget the past are condemned to repeat it, which is a cliche, but I think it's something that people in memory studies share. Although I should put a footnote on the Santayana quote, is because I'm sort of a little obsessive, I actually decide I can't just take that quote without having read Santayana. So I went back and looked at Santayana. And what I find is that quote, which is really common discourse, probably should be canceled because it comes from a context where he's trying to sort of disparage pre-modern people. It's pre-modern people who are stuck, who can't remember the past and thus are condemned to repeat it. So it's drawing this sort of moderns versus primitives distinction.
That's interesting. So even he is misunderstood. That quote is misunderstood because it's not put in context.
Yes.
But I think in addition to anchoring this field of memory studies in a history, and a lot of your time is spent defending it, and it has come under attack in part because it's misunderstood. And you've written about how at least certain historians see this as a threatening development, and they tie it into the emergence of a particular political context. Could you explain what that is? What are the criticisms of historians, and how do you try to react to that?
Yeah, the criticism of historians are, I mean, there are multiple ones. The first place is sort of epistemological. That is, historians want records. They want things that are measurable. They want things that would count as evidence in a court of law, whereas memory seems to them to be a fairly squishy notion. One of the things we know about memory is it's very changeable. The records in the archives are the records in the archives. The stories people tell change across their lives. And so do we take memories as evidence? Memory studies is not proposing that we take memory of an event as evidence of actually what happened. We're taking it as evidence of itself. That is how people construct what happened. And so I think the distinction between history and memory is a false one. At a more political level, there is a debate between about the usefulness of remembering. So, I mean, it goes all the way back to Nietzsche in The Uses and Abuses of History for Life, where Nietzsche says that, you know, too much memory can be the grave digger of the present, right? If you're stuck in the, you know, we all know people who are stuck in the past who can't get over a past slight or are unwilling to accept change that's happened, or the idea that, oh, we know things went badly last time, so I'm not willing to take the risk of doing anything. Nietzsche is concerned with the ability to take action and be heroic and these kinds of things, that if we're aware of all the people who got killed the last time we tried to accomplish something great, then we're never going to try to accomplish something great again. In the current context, the question is whether all the attention to memory keeps people stuck in their own grievance and victimhood culture. So there's a big debate going on that, you know, since World War II, we've had a powerful impetus to so-called never forget, or the obligations or duty of memory. In 2000, leaders of European nations met in Stockholm and signed what's called the Stockholm Declaration, which commits European nations to recalling the Holocaust, to commemorating the Holocaust, to acknowledging the importance of the Holocaust. The question is whether that has actually made us better actors in the present. The idea is if we remember these atrocities, then we will never again do these kinds of things. And yet what we see is that there have been plenty of genocides and there's plenty of violence and there's plenty of brutality, even though or even while we're commemorating past atrocities. So the question is, does the commemoration of past atrocities underwrite a less atrocious future? And that's actually an empirical question which people are debating. Has all of this memory helped us act better? Has it made us more moral in our politics? What kinds of memory tend to be salutary and what kinds of memory tend to be parochial? So, for instance, if we raise the Holocaust above all other atrocities, does it mean that we canonize the Jews? A mixed metaphor. We canonize the Jews as the consummate victims, which isn't exactly a healthy identity either. And does that embrace of victimhood status enable a kind of politics which is blind to the damages that can be done? This is a debate that's going on right now in memory studies. Has the overwhelming focus of some memory studies at some points in time on the Holocaust as the paradigmatic case somehow contributed, I think it's a very complicated notion, contributed to the actions of Israel in Gaza. That sort of a siege mentality, for instance, that results in lashing out that we wouldn't want to embrace. So there's the question of how do we get it right? What's a helpful kind of memory? You don't want to have so many monuments that you can't drive through a city because the intersections are blocked. You don't want to have so many holidays that you can't park your car on the street, or we can't get normal garbage collection done because everybody has a holiday that needs to be commemorated. By the same token, we don't want to whitewash the past. This is a debate that's happened recently in the United States, particularly even in Charlottesville, where I live, right? We had this riot about it. We have these statues to the American Confederacy, Robert E. Lee, Stonewall Jackson, even some questions about Thomas Jefferson. We learned a lot about Thomas Jefferson and his relationship with Sally Hemings. Do we continue to unproblematically heroize Thomas Jefferson when he did things that we would not, from our contemporary perspective, approve of, and even that people at the time, Jefferson not least, might not have approved of either, even though he was doing them? Jefferson was a slaveholder. What do we do with that? Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson were military leaders of an insurrection. The North supposedly won that war, and yet the South is saturated with nostalgic commemorabilia to this lost cause. And the lost cause seems to be commemorated in the South as much as the end, more than the end of slavery. Is it okay to leave those statues in place, or do we want to do something different? Do we want to, maintain the heroic stature of people like Jefferson or Washington who were slaveholders? Or do we want to contextualize it? Do we want to complexify it? Do we want to have a different tour, a different story we tell when people go to Monticello, Jefferson's home, that it's not all about the great Enlightenment figure with all of his inventions and how clever and great a guy he was, which he was, and did some fantastic things? How much do you talk about the fact that he was a slave owner? How much do you talk about his sexual relationship with Sally Hemings?
As long as you don't need federal funding, Jeff, you can talk as much as you want about it.
Well, it's amazing how much things change and how quickly they change. So I remember it was right after the 2017 riots about the statues. My parents were visiting, and they'd never been to Monticello, and we needed something to do, so we drove them up to Monticello. And this was like a week or two after the riots. And what was really interesting to me is that the story had changed. There was an investment in a more critical history at Monticello, but it was a tense tour because there were people on both sides, and somebody in the tour group was trying to press the tour guide. Well, but wasn't it true that he was financially unable to free his slaves, and so it wasn't his fault? And there was debate over the story. So in late 2017 and 2018, we had this pretty big sea change in American memory, but you're referring to the ways in which things have, in fact, even moved back since Trump came back to office. You know, in the first Trump administration, the 1619 Project came out, which was this project to reexamine American history and to sort of recenter the role of slavery in setting up the institutions of the United States and their important legacies for American politics and society. And in the first Trump administration, he appointed something called the 1776 Commission, which was supposed to push back on that. But we had this movement since 2017 that there were a lot of name changes. The Woodrow Wilson School of International Affairs at Princeton lost the name Woodrow Wilson. The statues came down. Schools changed their names. Street names were changed. There was a lot of reworking of American history. with the second Trump administration, the army bases changed their name. Fort Bragg had its name changed. Now, of course, in the second Trump administration, things are moving back in the opposite direction. And so I wrote an article, I think I sent to you, on what I called American exceptionalism that was written in the wake of 2017. Isn't it amazing how quickly things changed? I've now had to update that article to say, and isn't it amazing how short-lived those changes were and how much we've swung back in the other direction?
Yeah. So but just to rewind a little bit, so in part to go back to historians feeling uncomfortable with the squishy nature of memory studies, I thought one of your points was also that they conflate what they see as a heritage industry, an interest in the past, which is in part a misreading of at least that present, with the emergence of memory studies. They just see it as part of this industry. And then to go on to your point, I mean, you're often cited for your book, The Politics of Regret. And this is a labeling of this present context where nations have these difficult histories to deal with. And it's not as easy to celebrate the past like they did. That 19th century traditional form of national memory doesn't work as well in the present. And you offer some explanations for that, which I would hope you'd explain a little bit. Why doesn't that work? Why can't you? I mean, it's clearly what Trump wants to do. He wants to have a more celebratory national memory that he sees will pull the country together. So why is that more problematic? And then, of course, all of your work on Germany is looking at this country that has this past that you can't sweep under the rug. So you've got to deal with it. And Germany is often cited as the memory champion. Look at them. They've confronted their past. I've kind of cast Germany in that way. I started the podcast interviewing Susan Neiman, learning from the Germans. And that was her point, that her own lived experience, it was that it was an uncomfortable place when she went there first in the 1980s. It became a much more open place, welcoming place, within a decade, at least once you push into the 1990s. And she credits that to confronting the past, having the courage to confront the past. So Germany is often cited as an example of, well, look at how you benefit when you look at the past in an honest way. But then I read your book about the sins of the fathers, and I read it as a giant yes, but. Yeah. And you finish and you give Germany a lot of credit for taking responsibility, but throughout the entire book, there are just caveats throughout. There are escape clauses, and it's that language. They craft a language early on for dealing with that past, this grammar of exculpation. They craft a language that. It always allows them to minimize, deflect blame, and that really never goes away. It doesn't matter what the political context is. That's consistent throughout. So my question is, we're living in this age of the politics of regret. On the one hand, you refer to the article on American exceptionalism. You cast the United States as something different, that it really hasn't been a part of that. It's been basking in its traditional narrative, feel-good narrative, and maybe that's changing. And you point to things like the shooting in Charleston, the events in Charlottesville as a turning point, and you're updating that now because, well, maybe that turning point was history that, like the 1848 revolution, was history that failed to turn. So I have two questions, really. Well, if we look at Germany as the example, how successful, how much of a model does that serve? And then if we look at the U.S., what are all the things that constrain efforts to confront the past? So the politics of the present is a part of it, but you point to a number of other things in your article. How can you have all these statues in your midst? I mean, I went to UNC Chapel Hill. Those statues were all around me. I walked by them. I didn't pay attention to them. So what explains that?
Yeah. So there's a lot in there, a lot of different themes. Let me try to tease them out. I'm glad you mentioned Susan Neiman. I think actually she's changed her tune in the last 4 or 5 years. And one of the reasons is that the German story has gone through yet another twist. You're absolutely right that I've been less of a triumphalist about German memory, that in my reading of the grammar, what I called the grammar of exculpation, is that there were, I think of it as the cliche that Winston Churchill supposedly said about democracy, is it's a terrible system, but it's better than what's ever in second place. And I would say the same thing about German memory, is that they've done better than anyone else in sort of confronting and taking on difficult pasts, which isn't to say that I think they've done a perfect job. I think there are a lot of gaps. There's a trade-off, for instance, between accepting gestures on the part of the political leadership and the political establishment with a popular culture that doesn't quite as much. So, you know, there's a substitution effect. If the chancellor apologizes, then I don't have to. And so there were deals made. We're going to do this kind of commemoration, but we're not going to look too much at that. So, for instance, in the 1940s and the 1950s, we're going to change the institutional structures, which is an acknowledgement of and a reaction to what they did. By the same token, we're not going to delve too much into individual people's pasts, and that we're going to put sort of limits around the people who are going to be brought up on trial. And there are groups of people that, because we need the new polity to function, that we're just going to let things be. And so there's always sort of a trade-off and a balance. There are also, there are always competing forces in the history of post-war Germany. There are those who want Germany on its knees, as in the famous image of Willy Brandt at the Warsaw Ghetto Memorial. But there are others who are recalcitrant resistors and barely want to acknowledge that anything was wrong. This catastrophe was foisted upon us by the Treaty of Versailles, or that Hitler was an alien force and we're not responsible.
Which is part of how you that's part of the language of exculpation.
Right.
You talk about the past in these kind of like it's a natural disaster, like you have control over it. And I thought it was fascinating because that's exactly how, my episode with Marita Sterkin on 9/11 memories, that's how it came out of the blue.
That's right.
How could this happen to us?
Yeah. And that's a widespread story. I mean, I remember being struck when I visited Hiroshima, and there's the museum there, the Peace Museum, and I may be exaggerating and I hope I don't offend anyone, but my impression of that museum was the basic narrative structure as we were sitting in the park one day, minding our own business when suddenly, we were incinerated through no fault of our own. So there's a certain decontextualization that's really quite common. It's very hard to genuinely take on guilt. And it becomes harder it becomes both harder and easier over time. So by 1968, there was more interest in the Nazi past in Germany because the people who were insisting on acknowledging it weren't themselves complicit in it because they'd grown up after the war. So it's easier for a younger generation to acknowledge the sins of the fathers than it is to look inside and acknowledge our own sins. By the same token, there's also certain resistances and a derealization of what happened. There's good empirical research on this. There's a study done by the social psychologist Harald Welzer where he went into German schools and he sent them home with a project to talk to your grandparents. This was in the 90s, I believe it was. Talk to your grandparents and ask them what it was like and what they did during the war. And by this point in time, some of the grandparents were willing to talk about it. And they would say, yes, I joined the party. Yes, I did this. Yes, I did that. But the younger generation couldn't actually hear it. They say, yeah, but you weren't really a Nazi, because their image of what a Nazi was a cackling psychopath from a Hollywood movie. And they knew their grandma or their grandpa, and that's not you, and you're not an evil person, but you weren't really a Nazi. Oh, yes, I was really. I was in the party. I did this. But you weren't really one. You weren't one of the bad ones. And so there's this sort of derealization that happens over time. You're completely right that my characterization of the history of German memory is less triumphant than a lot of people. It's less triumphant than the Germans themselves would like to tell as a story. But also, I mean, when did I publish that book? Was 2016, and it was, you know, fairly retrospective. And I had stopped in originally the first version of that book stopped in 89, and then I added sort of an epilogue on what's happened since 89 to, I don't know, 2010, I guess I went up to. But just in the last 5 or 6 years in Germany, there's been yet another turn. Just like, you know, in the United States, we sort of had the breaking of the dam of this triumphant American memory with Charlottesville in 2017, and now we've sort of gone back in the other way. The same thing has happened in Germany, that there is a reaction to certain, I mean, it's a very strange reaction to certain uses of the past. So one thing that's happened in the last 5 to 10 years in Germany is the rise of a post-colonial perspective. And the argument is that is that the origins of exterminationist mentality were actually born not as was originally claimed in the 1980s in Stalin's gulags, but was actually born in the 19th century in German colonialism, for instance, in Namibia, and that there's been a forgetting of the Namibian genocide. And one of the reasons, it actually goes farther than this, one of the reasons that the Namibian genocide has been forgotten is because we're spending all our time in Germany remembering the murder of the Jews. And so the murder of the Jews is blocking out the atrocities of the colonial era. And so there becomes this sort of zero-sum argument. The more positive version of that is the really wonderful work by the literary theorist Michael Rothberg. I don't know if you've talked to Michael yet.
No, I haven't.
Yeah, on what he called multi-directional memory. And his argument, which is both empirical and normative, is that making each other aware of the different memories is actually multiplicative. That, you know, knowing a different story doesn't diminish the memory of your victimhood or the memory of a particular atrocity. It actually multiplies it and creates synergies, and we can sort of a moral universalism that can come out of that. And he does that empirically by tracing out, for instance, one of the interesting combinatorial instances he looks at is the ways in which the children of Turkish immigrants to Germany have dealt with or been exposed to or thought about the Holocaust and the Nazi era, things that happened in Germany before their parents even migrated in the 60s and 70s and before they were born. How does somebody of Turkish descent growing up in Germany take on German memory of the Holocaust? By the same token, these kinds of debates have been misused in contemporary Germany so that the far right, the AfD, the right-wing parties have sometimes used Holocaust memory, which they didn't used to like, as a way of generating an anti-Muslim politics by saying, well, the Muslims are the real anti-Semites, and so we are committed to the proper German memory of the Holocaust, which is threatened by Muslim immigration, which is completely ridiculous because this twisting and turning by which suddenly the German far right becomes the defender of Holocaust memory is bizarre beyond imagination.
I thought, you know, reading your book, The Sins of the Fathers, because I had a chance to talk with Jenny Wustenberg, and I have an episode on her work on memory activists. And so I saw that as the flip side of the story. On the one hand, there are this grammar of exculpation, this failure to really do any sincere soul searching, and that triggers a lot of people to do that locally. Lot of the memory work that changes the memory culture happens locally. She talks about the history workshop movement, and then. Where I saw your book, The Sins of the Fathers, merging with hers was that there's this institutionalization of memory that happens. That once you push to the, I don't know whether it's the 1990s or before, that the people who are doing that grassroots memory work, now they become part of the establishment. And it's Holocaust memory that becomes the official memory. And she points out, well, that's a problem after unification because you have this part of the country that has their own memories of a difficult past, and there's no place for that within the official memory culture. So,
right.
I kind of wondered, well, sometimes the success of institutionalizing a difficult past, on the one hand, you stress that you water it down in that, you got a language, a routine. It's like going to church. You know, it's this time of the year. You know what the theme is, and you can just follow along, and you don't have to think a whole lot. The memory can get watered down in that respect, but it also can crowd out other memories. And she talked about how that there was kind of an unease with people who dominate the memory establishment with the Eastern European Germans. They saw the former Eastern Germans as too emotional, too personally caught up in their path. They didn't really understand how memory is supposed to work, how you do it.
It's immensely complicated. I think extremely highly of Jenny Wustenberg and her work. It's and in a way a great, I think our work complements each other. I do a top down looking at official memory, and she looks at vernacular or popular memory or memory movements. And what she's able to document is truly extraordinary people doing truly extraordinary things and confronting the past in ways. But of course, this is very partial. She's studying people who are doing this kind of work. There are a lot of people who aren't doing that kind of work. You mentioned the East German complexity. It's interesting. There's this term in German, it's a real mouthful, Vergangenheitsbewältigung, which translates or not as mastering of the past. And so they talked about the Vergangenheitsbewältigung. We're talking about the 1950s, sort of trying to figure out what we're going to say about it and getting it established, and so it's under control. After 1989, with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the opening up of the Warsaw Pact states, the end of East Germany, we started referring to the second Vergangenheitsbewältigung, or the second mastering of the past. And the question was, how does the mastering of the communist past of decades of East German rule and what it did to its population and the, the border shootings and things like that and the repression of that society. How does that, on the one hand, affect the ways in which we're remembering the Nazi era, but how do the models of remembering the Nazi era affect how we're going to confront the second mastering of the past? What I would say now is that we've moved on to a third mastering of the past, which is into that equation of mastering the Nazi past, mastering the communist past. Now we're trying to master, or bringing into the equation, masking the colonial past, which was never, up until the 2000s, part of the discourse at all. And so things get even more complicated.
So that's a blind spot. Europe.
Yes. Yeah. Although, I mean, post-colonial theory and post-colonial politics have in some ways, at least on the left and in parts of the center, have become the standard, have become the dominant regime. So that and you see this, for instance, in debates about Israel in German and European politics, very vigorous protests. There's sort of this schizophrenia in I don't use that term in a technical sense, but in Germany, on the one hand, I remember after October 7th visiting Munich, and there was the Israeli flag right in Marienplatz, the center, tourist square in Munich, and there's a giant Israeli flag, and we stand with Israel after October 7th. By the same token, the protests at German universities, for instance, pro-Palestinian protests, have been particularly vigorous. And the German left seems to have embraced that as much, if not more, than in the United States. So you've got these sort of two competing memory cultures, and there's a lot of anxiety about how those two can coexist and what are the implications of one for the other. I mean, I saw it in my work early on when I was looking, for instance, during the first Gulf War, for instance, when German foreign policy leaders had this question, what do we do? On the one hand, Saddam Hussein is shooting Scud missiles at Tel Aviv, and we have a moral obligation to protect Israel. On the other hand, because of our belligerence in the first half of the 20th century in Germany. We are prohibited from engaging in military action outside the defensive area of NATO. And so we can't send. And so there was a whole debate, for instance, about whether you allow the American military jets to refuel in Germany or fly over Germany, or what kind of military aid Germany was going to give, whether they were going to contribute to the defense of Israel. And there was no, the past did not give a clear answer. We see another version of this right now in the tension between Germany's traditional ritualistic commemoration of the Holocaust and acknowledgement of special responsibility to Israel and to Jews more generally, with the sense that the lessons of the Holocaust and never again, and the assertion that Israeli actions in Gaza are genocide, that how can Germans remain silent and not? So they're caught between a rock and a hard place. And it's been really fascinating from a sociological perspective to watch this play out. It's also played out in the Memory Studies Association itself, where when we met in Prague last year, there were issues raised that has memory studies as a discipline paid too much attention to the Holocaust, and thereby can it be seen as feeding into an Israeli sense of victimhood, which is underwriting actions. And we've had a vigorous debate over that. And there's, I think there's healthy room for disagreement. So
I can tell you, Jeff, though, narratives of victimhood are everywhere.
Yes. Well,
do this interview people long enough who've written on memory issues in national context, and you run into it time and again.
Yeah. Which raises the question of where is this politics, what I call the politics of regret? Where is the, you know, there's been a lot of critique from all sorts of different places, some legitimate and some that I don't consider legitimate, over the category, the culture of complaint, or the politics of victimization, that when did we all want to be victims? Every group seems to now, the stories we tell seem to be reoriented as victimhood stories, because victimhood is the coin of the realm. Victimhood is the way you extract resources, the way you attain status, the way you assert yourself in moral discourse.
So
the way you see yourself.
To go back to American exceptionalism, is this what sets us apart that we're, I mean, we have that, but there's a strong pushback against that culture of victimhood, the difficult emphasis on digging into difficult histories, or the thinking that nations have to explore difficult pasts, that they can't just fall back on feel-good narratives.
Yeah. Right.
How much of a turning point were the events of in Charleston, in Charlottesville? Were they just a short-lived blip? I mean, I had an episode on Civil War monuments, and the point that was made at the end is like, well, most of these monuments are still standing there. Right. Not too many in the grand scheme of things were taken down. If anything, a legal infrastructure was created to protect them, to keep
That's
them
right.
in place.
Yeah. You know, I think... I think the politics of regret are here to stay. I think that once you get the idea out that these things happen, there is some investment, both institutional and individual, in maintaining that kind of a memory. I don't think it will ever be solved. I don't think there's a settlement, a treaty about memory to be signed, or and there will always be Confederate statues and lost cause proponents and people who want to talk about Southern heritage. By the same token, I do think our sensibilities have been changed. One of the interesting things, for instance, is you know, there was a while where people wanted to have weddings at plantations. You know, it's a, you want to have a big wedding. You want to have a nice party. You need some grass. You need a nice house in the background. You need a place you can put up a tent. And you know, if you live in certain parts of the country, well, a plantation is just, you know, in Charlottesville, weddings happen at wineries. In the South, a lot of weddings were taking place at plantations. It was a venue. And there was a lot of, there's a newfound cringe, if you will, about the idea of doing that without some historical awareness. by the same token, there's one I keep on my computer desktop was either a Yahoo or a TripAdvisor review about someone who went to a tour at a plantation and said, "I'm tired. I expected to hear about the pretty dresses and the nice house, and all they talked about was slavery. Boy, was that a bummer! I don't want to go back. How dare they? I'm going to go find one where they don't talk about that stuff." Or there was an exchange of letters, I don't remember, I think it was in the newspaper a while back, where a African-American woman was asked to be a bridesmaid at her white friend's wedding, which was taking place at a plantation. And they were all supposed to dress up in the, you know, in the antebellum dresses and do Gone with the Wind kind of pre-war Gone with the Wind kind of wedding theme. And the woman wrote to her friend and say, "Here's why I'm not going to come to the wedding and why I'm really sad about this." And the friend was like, "What's wrong with you? That all happened a long time ago. It's got nothing to do with us. Now put on the big dress and hold an umbrella and say, and have your mint julep," kind of thing, without any acknowledgement of the history. I think the cat's out of the bag. I don't think we're going back to sort of an unproblematic for the center, attitude towards these things. That no matter how much pushback there is from the 1776 project, or how many Confederate generals Pete Hegseth puts back on base names, I think the issue is already out there and people are aware of it. So I think the center has shifted.
But I thought one of the points I've heard you make is that. On the one hand, memory studies goes beyond the container of the nation state, and we look at ways in which people bring memories with them across borders. I had an episode on the Taiwanese who come from mainland China after the defeat of Chiang Kai-shek and the different memory communities there. And ways in which memories get entangled. And I had an episode on the memory of partition and how memories of Pakistan and India and Bangladesh get interwoven. But I've heard you say that, well, let's not forget, though, as important as this work is, that nations still matter, official memory still matters. It weighs heavily on the mnemonic landscape. I mean, I started my day reading about Trump putting in his a new portrait in the National Gallery and insisting that certain references to the past, to impeachments and January 6th be taken out, with a threat of funding cuts that the Smithsonian could if it doesn't get in line, is at risk of losing significant amounts of money, and we've seen universities cave to that threat. So.
Yeah.
The nation state and those who manage it still weigh heavily can't be discounted. And that kind of goes into, we're in this populist age now that's happening globally, where we see leaders on the right who are kind of rolling back democracy in different ways. And memory is a part of this. So I don't know whether the U.S. is a part of that trend, or it's set apart because it has a different relationship with its past. I don't know how unique we are. I had another episode on the memory of gun culture in connection with the NRA, and it was a Canadian scholar, and his point is the U.S. is misunderstood because people don't understand American memory, how unique American understanding of their own past, or at least the memory the National Rifle Association has been able to cultivate and instill in people, how particular that is, how enduring it is. Now, it could even outlast the NRA. So I guess I'm going back to this question of how unique, how different is the U.S. In terms of the way we see our past, in terms of the current populist moment. Are we getting in line with countries elsewhere? Are we charting out our own course? What do you see happening?
Yeah. So when I speak about, I talk about, there's this notion of American exceptionalism. What I said is there's also an American exceptionalism when it comes to memory, namely that while other countries around the world have sort of been forced to confront their difficult pasts. The United States, while there's always some discussion, when I think about what I learned or what I didn't learn, for instance, about Reconstruction in high school history, I think I learned nothing about it. Because it got in the way of a more positive story. The fact that the statues persisted, the fact that these names are on university buildings and on streets and on schools and army bases and things like that. The fact that America wants to see itself as on an upward trajectory, you look at the rhetoric of Martin Luther King Jr., where he talks about redeeming the promise that's in the founding documents, and that we like to see ourselves as having made progress. The civil rights movement is largely a story we tell ourselves about progress rather than impediments. Despite persistence of racial barriers, and that does seem to me to have changed since at least 2017 with an amazing sort of rapidity, right? I mean, if you look, for instance, at debates over names at universities. So, for instance, one example I've talked about is Calhoun College at Yale. And there was already a push from the kinds of memory activists that Jenny Wustenberg writes about in the German context. Let's change the name of Calhoun College because Calhoun made his money through the slave trade. And right up until the Charleston shootings, nothing doing. They had first they said no, and then they appointed a committee, and the committee said no, and then they asked the president to intervene, and the president said no, and then they said yes, right? And then it changed, right? And so I think that once that's happened, there is a new story, and this was what I referred to as the end of American exceptionalism when it came to memory. Sure, there's been a backlash. Sure, there is a counter narrative that persists. If I were, for instance, you mentioned efforts to, change portraits, the rework the memory of January 6th to provide alternative narratives. If I were to advise the right, which I wouldn't do, but advise the Trump administration about how to do that, I would say gentle works more than crass. Instead of, issuing an executive order, take out all mentions of slavery from the Smithsonian, or eliminate black people from the National Gallery, or whatever kind of extreme measures you can imagine. I would say small steps are likely to be more durable because they're less noticed and less likely to produce a response. But the response is there, and there is a core of civil society. I think racial politics in the United States have changed in the younger generation. Ideas and experiences that I grew up with are very different from the ones that my kids grew up with. Just like they're, in my lifetime with sexuality, for instance, when I was in school, unmentionable words, insults about one's sexuality. If you dropped a ball in the baseball game, you got called an epithet for a homosexual. And I just don't see that happening. The speed with which it's very slow from one perspective, but I don't think that they're going to be able to change the cultural shifts that have taken place back. And I think that that's true about acknowledging the complexities of the American past. So maybe this is a peculiar form of optimism, I guess.
Maybe if you talk the talk, then you've got to walk it.
There you go.
As well.
You also mentioned transnationality. There's this wonderful concept from my colleague Astrid Erl called traveling memory. And it's in the same school as Michael Rothberg's multi-directional memory. Memory is actually a lot more complicated, especially in fluid immigrant cultures and with worldwide patterns of communication. The speed with which ideas cross borders, the amounts of mixing and multiple identities that we have. In the 19th century, if you immigrated to the United States, it was a long and arduous journey. Now, it's still arduous, but you get on an airplane and you arrive in Kennedy Airport or something like that. There are other more difficult ways of getting here, but people can move from Delhi to New York in, you know, 16 unpleasant hours on an airplane, that was a different story 150 years ago. And if you want to go back, or the communication, I mean, it's just, even in the time of our lives, when I went to Germany to do my field work in early 1990s, you know, one 10-minute phone call a week, and there's no, and if you wanted to send someone a message, you wrote an actual letter in an envelope with a stamp on it with a pen, you know. And then when my daughter spent a year in Germany recently, you know, she had her Netflix account and Zooming with her friends and WhatsApping and all that kind of thing. And so the speed with which ideas and cultural exchanges and even just in language, when you go to Germany today, half the university courses are, I'm exaggerating, but a lot of university programs are in English. And everybody, you can walk down the street and into any shop and speak English without worrying that you won't be understood. Even in the 35 years since I lived in Germany, where in the smaller towns, you couldn't assume that everybody would be able to communicate with you. The world has in this way become a smaller place. And I think this is a way of, so the nation states are still important in setting curricula and building monuments in putting stuff out on the media. But the media themselves, that was a comment that was when CNN was an American enterprise, or most people got their news from CNN, certain people got their news from CNN. But now it could be Al Jazeera, it could be BBC World, it could be any website you want to go on. And so even in the last 10 years, there's been a lot more traveling of memory.
I have one final question that I'm just personally intrigued by. I really love this one guy, Brian Stevenson, and I just tend to get absorbed whenever he's making a presentation. And of course, he has this, he's the creator of this Equal Justice Initiative, and he started off in the law trying to get, with lawyers trying to get people off death row, and then realized in a changing legal landscape, maybe you got to work on the memory culture and do consciousness raising. Through museum work, through memorials, and he has his national memorial for lynching and his museum connected to that. And I've heard him many times talk about, well, I don't want to make people feel guilty. That's not what I'm after, but I need to, people should have an understanding of these dark chapters in their past. Otherwise, you're really not kind of addressing these root problems, and they can persist into the present if you're looking at mass incarceration and disproportionate numbers of African Americans or whatever it is. If you don't address the past, then it can live on. It can persist into the present and future. And but there's this powerful kind of Christian concept, which I've heard you address, that and memory is often cast in terms of contrition and atonement and redemption or grace or even Freudian constructs of, you know, can deal with the past or it's going to come back to get you in a problematic time. And I don't know how much of that is helpful. I'm just curious, is that a helpful way of thinking about it, or is this just the narrow cultural framework that we often look at memory in terms of, especially as we grapple with our own national history? Is it, and I've heard you say, well, there are other frameworks of memory, and there's a Jewish framework for memory, and maybe others might be more helpful. I did interview one scholar, and he talked about, you know, the Taiwanese from mainland China and how the whole Freudian construct wasn't helpful at all. He said that's like they weren't trying to recover a repressed or lost memory; they were trying to reconnect with ancestral ties. And he tapped into that multi-directional memory idea. Yeah. So I don't know whether, but I hear that time and again, as much as I love listening to Brian Stevenson talk, and that's typically how he justifies his work, is that we need to confront the past because we need to atone for this. And then even reading your book on the sins of the fathers, it's like, well, if you never acknowledge collective guilt, if it just becomes ritualized, like, how empty is that? Are you really taking on any kind of responsibility? If you go full on with a Christian idea, do you have to be, have some real sincere sense of contrition, of remorse, of collective guilt? And if you don't, then it's just superficial.
You know, guilt is a really complicated notion. And I'm not sure that the word guilt in the English language captures a natural type, or whether it groups together bunches of different things. So in the first place, you referred to collective guilt. There's collective guilt and individual guilt. I have individual guilt for wrongs I've done to people in my life. I'm also aware of the fact that the country whose passport I carry enslaved people for 500 years. Anachronistic, because the country didn't start till later, but has a history of slavery and ongoing unjust inequalities. I wouldn't say I don't feel guilty at all for that, because there are ways in which I contribute to that in my everyday life, whether I want to or not. So there's individual guilt and there's collective guilt. There's also guilt for things that you've done, but also you can feel guilt for things that you haven't done, or shame. Shame and guilt are an interesting pair. When you find out that somebody has gone through something atrocious, just as a moral human being, don't you feel a little bit of shame that we live in a world in which such things happen? Other part of this penumbra of concepts is responsibility. What responsibility do we have for it? You know, if somebody, if you find out that somebody has gone through something absolutely appalling and atrocious and is really suffering as a human being, I don't think it's okay to say, well, I didn't do it, so it's not my problem. I'm just going to treat you like everybody else. No, we treat people on the basis of our knowledge of who they are and where they come from and what they've been through. And I don't have a philosophical problem with that. Part of the German discourse, there was a really important work by the philosopher Karl Jaspers, where in 1945 to 46, he gave a series of lectures where he differentiated different kinds of guilt. He talked about political guilt and moral guilt and criminal. So criminal guilt is the normal stuff that I pulled the trigger and therefore I can be punished and sent to jail. But there's also moral guilt, like, did you stand idly by while things that you knew were inappropriate were happening to your neighbors and say, well, I'm not a hero, I'm not going to do anything about it. There is some moral guilt, even if you couldn't be expected to act heroically. There's also political guilt. Have you supported something which either at the time you knew was wrong, but were doing it for self-interested reasons, or have come to think about differently? So, for instance, I'll give an example which may be controversial and some people will be annoyed by it. In light of lots of discourse about Donald Trump's sexual history, I came to rethink my support earlier on for Bill Clinton. In the Lewinsky affair, I thought, this is a nothing burger and leave the guy alone and this is just pure politics. I've come to think, 20 years later, that we should have done something maybe a little bit, we should have reacted a little bit different. I should have reacted a little bit differently and not say nothing to see here. Maybe he should have resigned. Maybe it wasn't appropriate. And we've come, Monica Lewinsky is an interesting figure we've come to think about differently than we thought of her at the time. So there's political guilt, but then Jaspers really brings it home into the religious framework. He talks about what he calls metaphysical guilt, which is akin to original sin in some ways. But metaphysical guilt is the knowledge that we have by living in a world in which people are degraded. I take on some metaphysical guilt. It's why I do the kind of work that I do. I think some metaphysical guilt is part of wanting the world to be a better place. And so I don't, the people who say, I don't want to make anyone feel guilty, or don't you teach anything that's going to make our children feel guilty. Maybe guilt isn't the right word, but a sense of responsibility or a realistic awareness of what has happened in human history, I think is absolutely essential, and we can't live without it.
Thank you so much for taking time to talk with me. Very, very nice of you. Really enjoyed the conversation.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I've been talking with memory studies expert Jeffrey K. Olick. If you've enjoyed this or other episodes of Realms of Memory, subscribe on our YouTube channel, your favorite podcast app, send a link to a friend or family member, or review us wherever you can. Your support makes all the difference. I'm Rick Derdarian. Thanks for listening.